This episode was created with the support of Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. Visit us at freefm.org.nz.
Greetings, I am Barry. If you're searching for answers, spiritual help, clairvoyant readings, healings, crystals, books, incense, or jewellery, you need to go to Infinity, Hamilton Spiritual Centre, in the new premises at 550 Anglesey Street. Or you can phone us on 838 1838. This is your link between this life and the next. Become the change the world needs today. Can you hear the voice within? Can you hear me running? Can you hear me running? Can you hear me calling you? Can you hear the voice within? Can you hear me running? Can you hear me running? Can you hear me calling you?
The Voice Within, your connection between this world and the next. Brought to you by Infinity Spiritual Centre, 550 Anglesey Street, Hamilton.
Greetings, I am Barry. Now, we've got a special few weeks for you. This is a story about Michel Demarquet. He was born in France in 1931, and after travelling around the world, he ended up in Australia. And in 1987, he was abducted from this planet. He was taken to a planet known as Theoba, and then he took 3 years to write the book, which was initially called Abduction to the Ninth Planet, and then the Theoba Prophecy. Now, I don't know where the ninth planet is, but I know we're third rock from the sun. So enjoy this over the next few weeks. Part 1, Abduction to the Ninth Planet.
I awoke suddenly, not knowing how long I had slept. I was completely awake, fresh and alert, but good God, what time could it be? Lena was sleeping beside me, her fists closed, but then Lena always sleeps. I had no desire at all to go back to sleep, and besides, it was possibly already 5 a.m. I got up, made my way to the kitchen and checked the clock. Only 12:30 a.m. It was unusual for me to wake up at such an hour, took off my pajamas and dressed in trousers and a shirt. Why, I had no idea. Neither can I explain why I went to my desk, took a sheet of paper and a bureau and watched myself write, as if my hand had a mind of its own. My dear, I'll be away for about 10 days. Absolutely no need to worry. Leaving the note by the telephone, I headed through the door and onto the veranda. I avoided the table on which last night's chess game remained, with the white king still in checkmate, and silently opened the door leading onto the garden. The night seemed to be suffused with a strange brightness, which had nothing to do with the stars. Instinctively, I tried to recall what phase the moon was currently in, thinking that perhaps it was about to rise. Here, in the northeast of Australia where I live, the nights are generally quite clear. I descended the outside stairs and headed towards the Pandanus. Usually, at this time of night, we would have a veritable concert from the frogs and crickets whose churring sounds fill the night. Now, however, there was a heavy silence and I wondered why. I had only walked a few steps when, quite suddenly, the color of the philodendrons changed. The wall of the house too, and the pandanus, all were bathed in a kind of bluish light. The lawn seemed to undulate beneath my feet and the ground beneath the pandanus waved also. The philodendrons distorted and the wall of the house resembled a sheet floating in the wind. Beginning to believe that I was not well, I decided to return to the house when, at that precise moment, I felt myself lifted quite gently from the ground. I rose, slowly at first, above the philodendrons, and then quicker, until I saw the house becoming smaller and smaller below me. What is happening? I exclaimed in utter bewilderment. All is well now, Michel. By then, I believed I was dreaming. Before me, a human being of impressive size, dressed in a one-piece suit and wearing a completely transparent helmet on her head, was looking at me, friendly and smiling. No, you are not dreaming, she said, answering the question in my mind. Yes, I replied, but it always happens this way in a dream and in the end you find you've fallen out of bed and have a lump on your forehead. She smiled. Further, I continued, you are speaking to me in French, my native tongue, and yet we are in Australia. I do speak English, you know. So do I. It has to be a dream, one of those stupid dreams, moreover. If not though, what are you doing on my property? We are not on your property, but above it. Ah, it is a nightmare. You see, I was right. I'll pinch myself. I accompanied the words with the action. Ouch. She smiled again. Now are you satisfied, Michel? But if it's not a dream, why am I here sitting on this rock? Who are those people over there, dressed in the fashion of the last century? I was beginning to distinguish, in a milky light, people talking and at a slight distance, others moving around. And you, who are you? Why aren't you normal sized? I am a normal size, Michel. On my planet we are all this size. But everything in good time, my dear friend. I hope you don't mind me calling you that? If we aren't good friends already, I am sure that we will be soon. She stood there in front of me, intelligence reflected in her smiling face and goodness emanating from her entire being. It would not be possible to meet anyone with whom I could feel more at ease. Of course, you may call me what you wish. And what is your name? My name is Thou, but first, I would like you to know, once and for all, that this is not a dream. Indeed, it is something quite different. For certain reasons which will be explained to you later, you have been chosen to undertake a journey which very few Earthlings have made, particularly in recent times. We are, you and I, at this moment, in a universe which is parallel to that of Earth. In order to admit you, as well as ourselves, we have made use of an airlock. At this instant, time has stopped for you, and you could remain here 20 or 50 of your earthly years and then return as if you hadn't left. Your physical body would remain absolutely unchanged. But what are these people doing? They exist as well as can be expected and, as you will learn later, the population density is very low. Death only occurs by suicide or accident. Time is suspended. There are men and women, as well as some animals who are 30,000, 50,000 or even many more Earth years old. But why are they here and how did they come to be here? Where were they born? On Earth, they are all here by accident. By accident? What do you mean? It's very simple. You have heard of the Bermuda Triangle? I nodded. Well, quite simply, in this spot and in others less well known, this parallel universe becomes confused with your universe so that there exists between them a natural warp. People, animals or even objects finding themselves in the immediate vicinity of a warp are literally sucked into it. Thus, you can have, for example, an entire fleet of boats disappear in several seconds. Sometimes a person, or persons, can pass back into your universe after several hours, several days or several years. More often, however, they never return. When a man does return and relates his experience, the vast majority of people don't believe him, and if he persists, he is assumed crazy. Most of the time, such a person recounts nothing at all, realizing how he will appear in the eyes of his peers. Sometimes, too, he returns amnesic, and if he recovers some memory, it is not of what happened in the parallel universe, and therefore sheds no light on the subject. There was, Thal continued, a typical case of this passage into a parallel universe in North America, where a young man literally vanished while going to fetch water from a well which was situated several hundred meters from his house. About an hour later, family and friends set out in search of him and, as there had been a fresh snowfall of about 20 centimeters, it should have been quite simple. They had only to follow the footprints left by the young man. But, right in the middle of the field, the footprints stopped. There were no trees around, no rocks onto which he could have jumped, nothing strange or unusual, the footprints just stopped. Some people believed that he had been taken by a spacecraft, but that could not have been, as you will see later. This poor man had quite simply been sucked into the parallel universe. I remember, I said, I did hear of that particular case, but how do you know all about it? You will find out later how I know, she replied enigmatically. We were interrupted by the sudden appearance of a group of people so bizarre that again, I wondered if this was all a dream. About a dozen men, accompanied by what seemed to be a woman, emerged from behind a pile of rocks 100 meters from where we were. The sight was even stranger, since these human beings appeared to have stepped out of the pages of prehistoric records. With the gait of gorillas, they brandished enormous clubs which modern man would not have been able to lift from the ground. These hideous creatures were coming straight for us, howling like wild beasts. I made a move to retreat, but my companion told me there was nothing to fear and that I should stay still. She put her hand on the buckle of her belt and turned so that she faced them. I heard a series of small clicks and 5 of the strongest-looking men fell to the ground, motionless. The rest of the group stopped cleanly and began moaning. They prostrated themselves before us. I looked again at Thal. She stood like a statue, her face set. Her eyes were fixed on those people as though she was trying to hypnotize them. I later learned that she was giving orders by telepathy to the female of the group. Suddenly, this woman got up and began, it seemed to me, to issue orders in a guttural voice to the others. They then helped remove the bodies, carrying them on their backs to the pile of rocks mentioned earlier. What are they doing? I asked. They will cover their dead with stones. Did you kill them? I had to. What do you mean? Were we really in danger? Of course we were. These are people who have been here for 10 or 15,000 years. Who knows? We don't have time to establish that, and besides, it is of no importance. Nevertheless, it illustrates well what I was explaining to you a few moments ago. These people passed into this universe at a certain time, and they have lived in that time ever since. It's frightful, I agree. However, it is part of natural, and therefore universal, law. Furthermore, they are dangerous because they behave more like wild beasts than human beings. Dialogue would not have been possible between them and us, just as it is not possible between them and most of the others living in this parallel universe. For one thing, they are unable to communicate, and for another, they, less than anyone, understand what has happened to them. We were in real danger and, if I do say so, I have done them a favor just now, of liberating them. Liberating? Don't look so shocked, Michel. You know quite well what I mean by that. They are liberated from their physical bodies and are now able to continue their cycle, like every living being, according to the normal process. So if I understand correctly, this parallel universe is a curse. A kind of hell or purgatory? I didn't realize you were religious. I just make this comparison to show you that I am trying to understand, I replied, wondering how she could know whether or not I was religious. I know, Michelle, I was only teasing. You were right in explaining it as a kind of purgatory, but, of course, this is quite accidental. In fact, this is one of several accidents of nature. An albino is an accident, and a four-leafed clover can also be considered as an accident. Your appendix is just as much an accident. Your doctors still wonder what use it could possibly have in your body. The answer, no use whatsoever. Now usually, in nature, everything has a precise reason for existing, that's why I list the appendix among the natural accidents. People living in this universe suffer neither physically nor morally. For example, if I hit you, you would feel no pain, but if the blows were strong enough, although without pain, you could still die from them. This might be difficult to comprehend, but it is so. Those existing here know nothing of what I have just explained to you, and it is fortunate because they would be tempted to commit suicide, which, even here, is not a solution. What do they eat? They don't eat, nor do they drink, because they don't feel the need to. Here, remember, time has stopped, those dead won't even rot. But that's terrible. In all, the greatest service that one can render these people would be to kill them. You raise an important point there. Effectively, it would be one of two solutions. What is the other? To send them back where they came from, but that would pose great problems. Because we are able to make use of the warp, we could return many of them to your universe, and thus liberate them. But I'm sure you are aware of the enormous problems that would create for the majority of these people. Here, as I have already said, you have people who have been here for thousands of years. What would happen if they found themselves back in the universe they left so long ago? They might go insane. In all, there is nothing to do. She smiled gently at my affirmation. You are certainly the man of action we require, Michelle, but beware of jumping to conclusions. You have much more to see. She put her hand on my shoulder, having to incline forward slightly to do so. Although I didn't know it at the time, thou measured 290 centimeters, exceptionally tall for a human being. I see with my own eyes that we made the right choice in selecting you. You have an astute mind, but I cannot explain everything to you now, for two reasons. Namely, first, it is still too soon for such an explanation. By this, I mean that you must be instructed further on certain points before proceeding beyond. I understand, and second? The second reason is that they are waiting for us. We must leave. With a light touch, she turned me around. I followed her gaze and stared wide-eyed with surprise. About 100 meters from us was an enormous sphere, from which emanated a bluish aura. I later learned that it measured 70 meters in diameter. The light was not steady, but shimmered, resembling a heat haze when one looks from a distance at sand heated by the summer sun. This enormous sphere shimmered about 10 meters from the ground. With no windows, no openings, no ladder, it appeared as smooth as the shell of an egg. Thou signaled for me to follow her and we set out towards the machine. I remember that moment very well. During the short time we took in approaching the sphere, I was so excited that I lost control of my thoughts. A constant stream of images flashed through my mind, resembling a film in the fast-forward mode. I saw myself relating this adventure to my family, and I saw again newspaper articles I had read on the subject of UFOs. I remember a feeling of sadness sweep over me when I thought of my family whom I loved so much. I saw myself caught, as though in a trap, and it occurred to me that I might never see them again. You have absolutely nothing to fear, Michelle, said thou. Trust me. You will be reunited with your family very soon, and in good health. I believe my mouth fell open in surprise, triggering in thou a melodious laugh, such as is rarely heard among us earthlings. That was the second time she had read my thoughts. The first time I thought might have been a coincidence, but this time there could be no doubt. When we arrived in close proximity to the sphere, thou placed me in a position opposite her and about a meter's distance away. Do not touch me under any pretext, Michelle, whatever happens. Under any pretext, do you understand? I was quite taken aback by this formal order, but I nodded. She placed her hand on a type of medallion I had noticed earlier attached at the height of her left breast, and with the other hand, she held what resembled a large bureau which she unclasped from her belt. She pointed the bureau above our heads and in the direction of the sphere. I thought I saw a green beam of light flash from it, but I couldn't be sure. She then pointed the bureau at me, her other hand still on the medallion, and quite simply, we rose, simultaneously, towards the wall of the machine. Just when I was sure we were going to collide with it, a portion of the hull retracted like an enormous piston in the core of a cylinder, revealing an opening, oval in shape, of about 3 meters in height. We regained our feet, thou and I, on a type of landing inside the craft. She let go of her medallion, and with a dexterity that suggested she had done it often, she refastened her bureau. Come, we can touch each other now, she said. Taking me by the shoulder, she guided me towards a small blue light, so intense that I had almost to half close my eyes. I had never seen a color like it on Earth. When we were almost below the light, the wall on which it was located, let us pass. That is the only way to describe it. From the way in which my mentor was leading me, I could have sworn I was going to have a handsome lump on my forehead, but we passed through the walls, like ghosts. Thou laughed heartily at the shocked expression on my face. That did me good. I remember that laugh, like a refreshing breeze and reassuring at a time when I was not feeling at ease. I had often spoken with friends of flying saucers, and was persuaded that they did, in fact, exist. But when you are actually faced with the reality, so many questions cloud your brain that you think it will burst. Of course, deep down I was delighted. From thou's manner towards me, I sensed that I had nothing to fear. However, she was not alone. I wondered what the others were going to be like. In spite of my fascination with this adventure, I still doubted if I would see my family again. Already, they seemed so far away, when only several minutes earlier I was in my own garden. We were now, gliding, at ground level along a tunnel-shaped corridor that led to a small room, the walls of which were of a yellow so intense that I had to close my eyes. The walls formed a vault, exactly as if we were inside an upturned bowl. Thou covered my head with a helmet made from a transparent material, and I found, by opening one eye, that this enabled me to tolerate the light. How do you feel? She asked. Better, thank you, but that light, how can you stand it? It is not a light. It is just the present color of the walls in this room. Why, present? Have you brought me here to repaint them? I joked. There is no paint. There are only vibrations, Michelle. You still believe that you are in your earthly universe, when you are not. You are now in one of our super long-range spacecraft, capable of traveling at several times the speed of light. We will be leaving soon, if you will lie down on this bunk. There, in the center of the room were two boxes, rather like coffins without lids. I stretched out in one of them and thou in the other. I heard her speak in a language unfamiliar to me, but very harmonious. I wanted to lift myself up a little but couldn't, being held by an unknown and invisible force. The yellow color progressively disappeared from the walls, to be replaced by a blue that was certainly no less intense. The paintwork had been redone. One third of the room suddenly became dark, and I noticed minute lights sparkling like stars. Thao's voice was clear in the darkness. "These are stars, Michel. We have left Earth's parallel universe and will be leaving your planet further and further behind to take you to visit ours. We know you are going to be greatly interested in the journey, but also in our departure that will be quite slow for your benefit. We can watch on the screen you see in front of you. Where is Earth? We still can't see it, being almost directly above it, at approximately 10,000 meters altitude." Suddenly, a voice could be heard, speaking what seemed to be the same language Thao had used moments earlier. Thao answered briefly, and then the voice spoke to me in French, excellent French, although the tone was more melodic than is typical, welcoming me aboard. It was very much the welcome aboard of our airline companies, and I recall being quite amused by that, in spite of the unique situation in which I found myself. At the same instant, I felt a very light movement of the air and it became cool, as though air-conditioned. Things began to happen quickly. On the screen, appeared what could only have been the sun. At first, it seemed to touch the edge of the Earth or, more precisely, South America, as I later learned. Again, I wondered if I could be dreaming. Second by second, America was shrinking. Australia couldn't be seen, as the sun's rays had not yet reached it. Now the contours of the planet could be distinguished, and we seemed to move around the globe, to a position above the North Pole. There, we changed direction, drawing away from Earth at an incredible speed. Our poor Earth became a basketball, then a billiard ball until it finally disappeared, or almost, from the screen. Instead, my vision was filled with the somber blue of space. I turned my head in Thao's direction, hoping for further explanation. "Did you like that? It was wonderful, but so fast, is it possible to travel at such a high speed?" "That was nothing, my dear friend. We took off very gently. Only now are we traveling at full speed." "How fast?" I interrupted. "Several times the speed of light." "Of light? But how many times? It's incredible. What about the light barrier? I can well understand that it appears incredible to you. Not even your experts would believe it. It is, however, the truth. You say several times the speed of light, but how many times? Michel, during this journey many things will be intentionally revealed to you, many things. But there will also be details to which you will not have access. The precise speed of our spacecraft is one such detail. I'm sorry, for I know it will disappoint you not to have your great curiosity for all things satisfied, but there will be so many new and interesting things for you to see and learn, that you must not mind too much when information is withheld from you. Her manner indicated that the matter was closed, and I didn't insist further, sensing that to do so would have been rude. "Look," she said to me. On the screen a colored dot had appeared and was growing rapidly. "What is it?" "Saturn." The reader must forgive me if the descriptions I give are not as detailed as he, she might wish, but it must be understood that I had not yet recovered all my senses. I had seen so much in so short a time, and was somewhat disoriented. As we approached, the famous Saturn grew rapidly larger on the screen. Its colors were wonderful, incomparable to anything I had ever seen on Earth. There were yellows, reds, greens, blues, oranges. Within each color, an infinite range of nuances mingled, separated, grew stronger then weaker, creating the famous rings and confined within them. It was an amazing spectacle, which filled more and more of our screen. Realizing I was no longer restrained by the force field, I wanted to remove my mask so as to see the colors better, but thou signaled that I should do nothing. Where are the satellites? I asked. You can see two, almost side by side towards the right of the screen. How far away are we? We must be approximately 6 million kilometers or perhaps more. They know exactly on the flight deck, of course, but to give you a more precise estimate, I'd have to know whether our camera is on full zoom or not. Saturn suddenly disappeared from the left side of the screen, which filled again with the color of space. I believe it was at that moment I felt exalted, as I never had before. It hit me that I was in the process of living an extraordinary adventure, and why? I had asked for nothing and had never contemplated the possibility, who would have dared, of experiencing such an adventure. Thou got up. You can do the same now, Michel. I obeyed and we found ourselves again, side by side in the center of the cabin. It was only then I noticed Thou no longer wore her helmet. Can you explain to me, I asked, why just now you were still wearing a helmet while I was able to accompany you without one, and yet now I have one while you don't? It is very simple. We come from a planet bacteriologically different from Earth, which, for us, is a veritable culture medium. Thus, in order to contact you, I was obliged to take this basic precaution. You, yourself, were a danger to me, but you are no longer. I don't follow you. When you entered this cabin, the color was too intense for you and I gave you the helmet you are now wearing, which was specially designed for you. Indeed, we were able to anticipate your reaction. During the very short time the cabin was yellow and then blue, 80% of the dangerous bacteria in you was destroyed. Then perhaps you felt a coolness in the air, similar to when an air conditioner is working. This was another form of disinfection by, let's call it radiation, although that is not the correct word. It cannot be translated into any Earth language. In this way, I have been disinfected 100%, but you still have enough bacteria to harm us considerably. I am going to give you these two pills, and in 3 hours you will be able to consider yourself as pure, as one of us. As she spoke, she took a little box from beside her bunk, removed the pills and held them out to me, along with a test tube containing a liquid that I supposed to be water. I swallowed them both, lifting the base of my helmet to do so. Next, well, everything happened very quickly and it was all very strange. Thou took me in her arms, put me on the bunk and removed my mask. I saw that happen from 2 or 3 meters from my body. I imagine that certain things in this book will seem incomprehensible to the unwarned reader, but I saw my body from a distance and I was able to move about in the room just by thought. Thou spoke, Michel, I know that you see me and hear me, but I am not able to see you myself, therefore I cannot look at you when I speak to you. Your astral being has left your body. There is no danger in this, you needn't worry. I know that this is the first time this has happened to you, and there are people who panic. I have given you a special drug in order to cleanse your body of all bacteria that is dangerous to us. I have also given you another drug that has caused your astral being to leave your body. This will last 3 hours, the time it will take to purify you. In this way, you will be able to visit our spacecraft, without danger of contamination to us and without wasting time. As strange as it seems, I found this quite natural, and I followed her. It was fascinating. She arrived in front of a panel that slid open to let us pass into one chamber after another. I was following at some distance and each time, if the panel had already closed by the time I reached it, I quite simply passed through it. Finally, we reached a circular room, about 20 meters in diameter, in which there were at least a dozen astronauts, all women and all about Thao's size. Thao approached a group of four who were seated in enormous, comfortable-looking armchairs, arranged in a circle. When she sat down in a vacant seat, the four heads turned towards her questioningly. She almost seemed to take delight in making them wait. Finally she spoke. I was again charmed to hear that language. The assonance was quite new to me, and the intonation so harmonious that one would have thought they were singing. They all seemed to be greatly interested in Thao's report. I supposed they were speaking of me, believing correctly that I was the main purpose of their mission. When Thao stopped, the questions streamed forth, and two other astronauts joined the group. The discussion swelled and developed a tone of increased excitement. Not understanding a word of what was being said, and having noticed on entering three people positioned in front of screens displaying three-dimensional images, more or less vividly colored, I approached to discover that this must certainly be the control room of the spacecraft. Being invisible made it even much more interesting since each person was performing her duties without being disturbed, or even distracted, by my presence. On a screen bigger than the rest, I was able to discern dots, some larger than others and some brighter, which moved steadily and without interruption in their prescribed directions, several towards the left of the screen and others towards the right. Their speed increased as they grew on the screen and finally exited from it. Their colors were often brilliant and extraordinarily beautiful, ranging from subtle tones to a blinding yellow, like the light from our sun. I soon realized that these were the planets and suns among which we were navigating, and I was absolutely fascinated by their silent progression across the screen. I can't say how long I had been watching them, when suddenly a strange sound filled the cabin, a sound which was soft and at the same time, insistent, and which was accompanied by many flashing lights. The effect was immediate. The astronauts who had been talking with Thao now approached the control post and each took a seat that seemed to be personally assigned to her. Everyone's eyes were fixed attentively on the screens. Right in the middle of these large monitors, I began to distinguish an enormous mass that is difficult to describe. Let me say only that it was round in form and blue-gray in color. It remained immobile in the center of each screen. In the room, all was silent. The general attention was focused on three astronauts in command of oblong-shaped pieces of equipment resembling, in some ways, our computers. Suddenly, covering a huge area of what I believed was a wall of the cabin, I was stupefied to see an image of New York. No. That's Sydney, I said to myself, and yet the bridge is different. Was it even a bridge? My surprise was such I had to ask Thao, at whose side I was standing. I had forgotten, however, that I was no longer in my physical body and no one could hear me. I was able to hear Thao and others commenting on what they were seeing but, not understanding their language, it didn't get me far. I was convinced, though, that Thao had not lied to me and therefore we had well and truly left Earth behind. My mentor had explained we were traveling at several times the speed of light, and I had seen Saturn pass by and later, what I took to be planets and suns, so had we come back, and why? Thao spoke aloud and in French, which caused all heads to turn in her direction. Michel, we are stationed above the planet Aremo X3, which is almost twice the size of planet Earth, and as you can see on the screen, quite similar to your world. I can't explain at any length our current mission as I am required to participate in the operation, but I will do so later. To put you on the right track, I will tell you that our mission concerns atomic radiation such as you know on Earth. Everyone seemed preoccupied. Each knew exactly what to do and when to do it. We were stationary. The large panel projected an image of the center of a town. The reader should understand that this large panel was in fact no more than an immense television screen, projecting an image in relief so real, we could have been looking out the window of a tall building. My attention turned to another smaller screen being monitored by two of my hostesses. On this panel I could see our spacecraft, as I had already seen it in our parallel universe. As I watched, I was surprised to see, slightly below the middle of our vessel, a small sphere ejected, like an egg from a hen. Once outside, this sphere accelerated rapidly towards the planet below. As it disappeared from view, another sphere emerged in the same manner, and then a third. I noticed each sphere was being monitored on separate screens by different groups of astronauts. The descent of the spheres could now be easily followed on the large panel. The distance should have made them invisible in quite a short time, but they remained in sight, and I deduced that the camera had to have an extraordinarily powerful zoom. Indeed, the effect of the zoom was so strong that the first sphere disappeared from the right of the panel and the second from the left. We could now only see the middle one and followed its descent to the ground quite clearly. It stopped in the center of an immense square, situated among apartment buildings. There it hovered, as though suspended several meters from the ground. The other spheres were monitored in the same detail. One was above a river that flowed through the town, and the other hovered above a hill near the city. Unexpectedly, the panel projected a new image. I could now distinctly see the doors of the apartment buildings, or rather, the doorways, for where doors should have been, were gaping openings. I remember clearly that, until then, I had not realized how odd this town was. Nothing had moved.
Part 2 of the continuing saga of Michel Democket.
Atomic destruction. A single word can impart what was being reflected from the panel: desolation. The street we were observing, piece by piece, was cluttered with mounds, generally arranged one behind the other. Some stood apart while others lay right in the middle of the openings to the buildings. Imperceptibly, the camera zoomed closer and I soon understood that these mounds had to be vehicles. Vehicles that were somewhat similar in shape to flat-bottomed boats. Around me, the astronauts were attending to their desks. From each sphere emerged a long tube that descended slowly towards the surface. When the end of the tube touched the ground, a little cloud of dust rose, and I realized that the vehicles too were covered in a thick blanket of dust, rendering them formless and unrecognizable. Of course, the sphere that hovered above the river had its tube in the water. My attention was now riveted on the panel, for the scene was quite fascinating. One had the exact impression of being in the street. My attention was especially drawn to a darkened place in the entrance of a huge building. I could have sworn something moved. I also felt there was a certain agitation among the astronauts. Abruptly, and with a series of jerks, the thing emerged into the light. I was horrified by what I saw. As for my hostesses, apart from some utterances spoken more quickly, and a few exclamations in which emotion could be discerned, I must say that they didn't really seem surprised. However, what we were seeing so clearly on the panel was a horrible cockroach, about 2 meters long and 80 centimeters high. The reader will certainly have seen, at one time or another, these nasty little insects we have on Earth, particularly in hot climates, living in cupboards and damp places. You will agree that they are loathsome, but the biggest would be no more than 5 centimeters in length. Imagine then, one with the dimensions I have just described. It was truly an abomination. The tube from the sphere began to retract, yet was still a meter from the ground when suddenly, The creature hurried forward to attack this thing which moved. Untrustingly, it stopped again, when from under the building, a veritable swarm of the creatures emerged, spilling one over the other. Just then, a ray of intense blue light beamed from the sphere and swept over the group, reducing it instantly to carbonized dust. A cloud of black smoke hid the entrance to the building from view. My curiosity further aroused, I watched the other screens, but they indicated no problems. The sphere from the river was returning towards us, and the sphere on the hill retracted its tube, moved a little higher and lowered the tube again, along with a second cylinder above the sphere. I had guessed, of course, that the astronauts were collecting samples of soil, water, and air. Being an astral body, I couldn't ask Thou any questions. In any case, she seemed quite busy conferring with two of the hostesses. The spheres began climbing towards us and were soon ready to be reabsorbed by our spacecraft. When the operation was complete, Thou and the two astronauts mentioned took their places opposite their respective desks. Instantly, the images we received on the panel and screens changed completely. I understood we were leaving when each one took her place. I observed that all the astronauts had a similar posture in their seats that intrigued me. I later learned that a force field restrained them exactly as a security harness would have restrained a stuntman on Earth. The suns illuminated the planet through a reddish fog. We had left by then, and I assumed we were following the contour of the planet, at the same altitude. In fact, we could see a desert-like area passing by, dissected by dry riverbeds that sometimes crossed each other at right angles. It occurred to me they might be canals, or at least had been man-made. The panel revealed images of a town apparently intact. Then it disappeared and the screen went blank. The vessel had obviously gained speed in flying over the planet, as the images on the smaller screens, showing a lake or inland sea, flashed by quickly. Suddenly, several exclamations were heard and we immediately slowed down. The panel was turned on and presented a close-up of the lake. We stopped. We could clearly see a portion of the coast and, beyond some large rocks by the lake, we could make out cube-like structures which I imagined to be habitations. As soon as we had stopped, the spheres began their operations again, just as they had earlier. We received some excellent shots taken from one of the spheres that hovered above the beach at a height I judged to be 40 to 60 meters from the ground. Its tube extended right to the shore. Very clearly, it transmitted a scene of a group of human beings. Indeed, at first sight, they were identical to people found on Earth. We had a very close view. In the middle of the panel appeared the face of a woman of uncertain age. She had brown skin, with long black hair that fell to her breast. As we could see on another screen, she was quite naked. Only her face appeared to be deformed, she was mongoloid. When I saw her, I didn't realize she was deformed, I simply assumed we had to contend with a race of humans only slightly different from our own, as science fiction writers like to describe them, all twisted, with big ears or such like. Still, we had other shots and, in this group, the men and women seemed to resemble the Polynesian race. It was, however, obvious that more than half of these people were either deformed or eaten away by what appeared to be leprosy. They were looking towards the sphere and gesticulating, appearing to be greatly agitated. Many more were emerging from the cubic constructions which proved to be their habitations, and on which I will elaborate a little. These structures closely resembled the blockhouse of the Second World War, to which had been added very thick chimneys installed, I supposed, for the ventilation of the buildings, which only seemed to rise about 1 meter above the ground. These blockhouses were all built with the same orientation, and the people emerging from them did so by openings on the sides which were in shadow. Without warning, I felt myself drawn backwards away from the panel. Rapidly, I passed through several partitions until I found myself once again in the cabin where my physical being lay stretched out on the bunk, just as I had left it. Instantly, everything was completely black. How well I remember the unpleasant sensation that followed. My limbs felt like lead, and when I tried to move them, it was as if I was paralyzed. I could not understand what prevented me from moving. I must confess I panicked a little and wished with all my heart that I might leave my physical body again, but I couldn't do that either. I don't know how much time elapsed before the cabin gradually became suffused with the most restful blue-green light. Finally, Thou entered, wearing a different suit. I am sorry to have made you wait, Michel, but just as your physical body recalled you, it was impossible for me to come and help you. Don't apologize, I understand perfectly, I interrupted, but I believe I have a problem, I can't move. I'm sure something in me is disconnected. She smiled and put her hand just beside mine, undoubtedly operating a control mechanism, and immediately I was freed. Again, a thousand apologies, Michel. I should have pointed out to you the spot where the control cell for the security harness is found. All the seats, beds or bunks are equipped with them, and they are automatically activated when occupied if there is the least possibility of danger. When the vessel arrives in a dangerous area, the three security computers cause the closing of the force fields, to use their proper name. When the danger has passed, they automatically release them. At the same time, if we do want to be released in a zone deemed dangerous, or even if we simply want to change position, we have only to pass a hand or just a finger in front of the cell and the force field is immediately neutralized. When we return to our seats, we will be automatically restrained again. Now, I'm going to ask you to go and change, I'll show you where. In the room, you will see an open trunk where you can put your clothes, in fact, all that you are wearing apart from the glasses. You'll find a suit there, which you are to put on before meeting me back here. Thou bent down and taking my hand, she helped me up. I was really quite stiff. I went into the small room she had pointed out, undressed completely and put on the suit, which fitted me perfectly. This was surprising, given that, in spite of my 178 centimeters in height, I was a dwarf compared with my hostesses. A short time later, back in the cabin, Thou handed me something in the form of a bracelet, which was actually a pair of enormous glasses. A little like motorcycle goggles, they were strongly tinted. At her request, I put them on, but to do so, I was obliged to remove my own glasses, as they would have been crushed by this larger pair. They fitted exactly into the shape of my eye sockets. A last precaution, she said. Lifting her hand towards the partition, she in some way released a certain mechanism, for the intense light reappeared and I felt the intensity in spite of the strong glasses. I was again aware of the current of cool air. The lights went out. The air current could no longer be felt, but Thou did not move, appearing to be waiting for something. Eventually a voice was heard and she removed my large tinted glasses. I replaced them with my own and she asked that I follow her. We took the same route as when I followed her in astral body, and we found ourselves again in the command room. One of the older astronauts, I say older but perhaps I should instead say more serious, as they all appeared to be about the same age, signaled briefly to Thou, who took me to a seat in front of the panel and asked that I stay there. She quickly rejoined her colleague and I realized they were very busy. As for me, I began checking whether I could in fact free myself from the force field. As soon as I sat down, I was effectively plastered to my seat, a feeling I did not like at all. Moving my hand slightly, I found I was immediately liberated for as long as my hand remained in front of the cell. The panel relayed an image of about 500 people standing on the shore and quite near the blockhouse. Thanks to the close-ups possible with our cameras, we had an excellent view of these people, who were quite naked, from the oldest down to the youngest. Again, I could see many of them were either deformed or sporting ugly wounds. They were all gesturing towards the spheres taking sand and soil samples, but no one approached. The strongest-looking men were holding what appeared to be machetes or sabers. They seemed to be watching something. I felt pressure on my shoulder and turned round, surprised. It was Thou. She smiled at me and I clearly remember appreciating, for the first time, the beauty and nobility of her face. I have already mentioned her hair, which was long and silky, golden blonde in color, which fell to her shoulders and framed a face that was perfectly oval in shape. She had a large, slightly protruding forehead. Her blue mauve eyes and long curled lashes would have been the envy of many women on our planet. Her eyebrows curved upwards, similar to the wings of a seagull, adding a unique charm. Under her eyes, which sparkled and sometimes teased, was her nose, well proportioned and slightly flat at the bottom, which accentuated a sensual mouth. When she smiled, she revealed perfect teeth, so perfect, one could believe they were false. This would have surprised me. The chin, well-shaped but slightly angular, suggested a willful determination that was somewhat masculine, but this did not detract from its charm. A faint shadow of hair above her upper lip could have spoiled this perfect face, were it not blonde. I see you already know how to free yourself from the force field, Michelle. I was about to reply when an almost general exclamation made us turn our eyes to the panel. The people on the beach were surging back en masse towards the habitations and dived inside in one big rush, while a line of men had been formed armed with sabers or picks, facing the most incredible thing I could ever have imagined. A group of red ants, each the size of a cow, were rushing from behind the rocks onto the beach. They moved quicker than horses in gallop. The armed men kept glancing behind, as if to compare the speed at which the people scrambled to safety with the advance of the ants. Already, the latter were near, too near. The men faced them bravely as, with only a second's hesitation, the first beast attacked. We could distinguish the mandibles clearly, each the size of a man's arm. At first, the creature feigned, enabling the man to strike with his saber, but he slashed only air. Immediately, the mandibles encircled his waist, severing him cleanly in two. Another pair of ants helped the first to shred him, while the rest launched their assault on the fleeing combatants, gaining rapidly on them, too rapidly. From the sphere, an electric blue beam of unbearable intensity shot out, just as the ants were upon the men. The creatures were struck dead, one after the other, with amazing precision and effectiveness. Curls of smoke rose from the burnt flesh of the animals strewn over the ground, their enormous legs convulsing in a last spasm. The beam continued its devastation among the ants, instantly and systematically annihilating the giant insects. They must have known instinctively that they could not match this almost supernatural force and fled in retreat. Everything had happened so quickly. Thou was still at my side, her face reflecting disgust and sadness, rather than anger. Another glance at the panel revealed a new scene, of the sphere pursuing the ants in their hasty retreat, not only with the camera, but also with the deadly beam. The rest of the swarm, which I estimated to comprise 600 or 700, were being decimated. Not one was left alive. The sphere returned to its earlier position above the beach and produced a special tool with which it combed through the carcasses. I could see one of the astronauts seated at her desk, talking into her computer. This prompted me to ask Thao if she was supervising the work being carried out. At the moment, yes, for this work was not originally scheduled. We are taking samples of these creatures, pieces of lung in particular, in order to analyze them. We think that certain types of radiation have produced this mutant form of creature. In fact, ants do not have lungs, but the only logical explanation for their sudden gigantism is. Thao stopped short. The camera was relaying a picture of the men now re-emerging form their shelters, gesticulating wildly at the sphere. They were holding their arms open wide and prostrating themselves on the ground. They repeated this pattern. Can they see this vessel? I asked. No. We are at an altitude of 40,000 meters, and, further, there are presently three layers of cloud between the planet and us. On the other hand, they can see our satellite, and I think it is to that they are addressing these gestures of gratitude. Perhaps they take the sphere to be a god which has saved them from ruin. It's quite possible. Can you tell me what is happening? Who are these people? It would take too long to explain to you, Michel, especially now with so much activity in the vessel, but I can satisfy your curiosity by explaining briefly. These people are, in a way, the descendants of certain ancestors of people existing still on your planet. In fact, a group of their ancestors peopled a continent on the planet Earth about 250,000 of your Earth years ago. Here, they possessed a civilization which was very advanced, but, having raised enormous political barriers between themselves, they finally destroyed themselves, 150 years ago, with the atom. Do you mean, a total nuclear war? Yes, brought about by chain reaction. We come, from time to time, to take samples in order to study the degree of radiation still existing in various regions. Sometimes too, just as a few moments ago, we help them. But they must take you to be God himself after what you did just now. Thao smiled and nodded her head. Ah yes, that's certainly true, Michel. They take us to be gods, exactly as, on your planet, certain of your ancestors also took us to be gods. Still, they talk of us. I must have shown complete surprise, as Thao threw me a look of amusement. I told you a moment ago that my explanation is somewhat premature. We'll have plenty of time to talk of this again. Besides, that's why you are with us. With that, she excused herself and resumed her place in front of a screen desk. The images were changing rapidly on the panel. The sphere was on its way up and we had a view of a whole section of the continent, on which, I noticed in places, patches of green and brown. The sphere took its place again within the vessel and we departed. We flew over the planet at a breathtaking speed and I allowed myself to be imprisoned in my armchair by the force field. On the screen were images of the waters of an immense ocean. We could distinguish an island, which grew rapidly. It seemed to be a very low island, although, for me, the problems of estimating dimensions were very real. The entire procedure, already described, was repeated. We stopped above the coast and, this time, four spheres left the spacecraft and descended to the island. On the panel, I could see a beach which the camera was scanning. On the water's edge lay what looked like thick slabs, around which were gathered naked men, the same kind we had seen earlier. They didn't appear to have noticed the sphere and I assumed that this time, it was at a much higher altitude, in spite of the ever-closing images we were receiving. On the panel, we could now see the men carrying one of the slabs into the waves. It floated, as if made of cork. The men hoisted themselves up onto it, grabbed large oars that they handled skillfully, and the boat took to the open sea. When they were a good distance from the shore, they threw out fishing lines and, to my surprise, almost immediately, pulled up fish of what seemed a respectable size. It was quite fascinating to see how these men were surviving, and to be capable of helping them, as if we were gods. I had released myself from the force field, wanting to go and study the other screens that were receiving different images. Just as I was about to venture from my seat, I received an order, without hearing a sound, "Stay where you are, Michel." I was stupefied. It was as if the voice was inside my head. I turned my head in Thao's direction and she was smiling at me. I decided to try something, and thought as hard as I could, "Telepathy is great, isn't it, Thao?" "Of course," she replied in the same manner. "It's wonderful. Can you tell me what the temperature is down there at the moment?" She checked the data at her desk. 28 of your degrees Celsius. By day, the average temperature is 38 degrees. I said to myself, if I was deaf and mute, I could communicate with Thao quite as easily as I can with the spoken word. "Exactly, my dear." I looked at Thao with some surprise. I had been making a personal reflection and yet she had intercepted my thoughts. I was a little put out by this. She gave me a wide smile. "Don't worry, Michel. I was merely being playful and I ask that you forgive me. Normally, I only read your thoughts when you ask me a question. I just wanted to demonstrate what is possible in this domain. I won't do it again." I returned her smile and redirected my attention to the panel. There I could see a sphere on the beach, very close to a group of men who didn't seem to notice it. This sphere was removing sand samples from a spot about 10 meters from the group. By telepathy, I asked Thao why these people were unable to see the machine. "It's night," she answered. "Night? But how is it that we can see things so clearly?" "Special cameras, Michel, something like your infrareds." Now I better understood why the images received were less luminous than on our preceding stops. However, the close-ups were excellent. Just then, on the panel, we had a shot of a face, apparently that of a female. It was really horrible. The poor creature had an enormous gash where her left eye should have been. Her mouth was positioned to the right of her face and appeared as a tiny little opening in the middle of her jaw, around which were lips that seemed fused together. On the top of her head, a single tuft of hair hung pitifully. We could now see her breasts, and very pretty they would have been, if one of them hadn't had a purulent wound on the side. "With breasts like that, she must be young?" I asked. "The computer puts the age at 19 years. Radiation? Of course. Other people appeared, some of whom were perfectly normal looking. There were males among them, with an athletic build, who looked to be in their 20s. What is the age of the oldest? Do you know? At present, we have no record of anyone older than 38 years, and a year on this planet is 295 days of 27 hours. Now, if you look at the screen, you can see a close-up of the genital area of that handsome and athletic young man. As you will note, the genitals are totally atrophied. We've already worked out, from previous expeditions, that there are very few men actually capable of procreation, and yet, there are great numbers of children. It's the survival instinct of all races to reproduce as soon as possible. Thus, the obvious solution would be that the males capable of reproduction are studs. This man must be one of them, I think." Indeed, the camera was showing a man of about 30 years perhaps, possessing physical attributes certainly capable of producing offspring. We were also able to see many children coming and going around small fires on which food was cooking. The men and women seated around the fireplaces were taking cooked pieces and sharing them with the children. The fires seemed like wood fires, but I couldn't be sure. They were fueled by something shaped rather like stones. Behind the fires, slabs similar to the boats seen earlier were piled and assembled so as to form shelters that looked quite comfortable. In the camera's field of vision, no trees could be seen. Perhaps they did exist, because I had noticed green patches earlier as we flew over the continent. From between two huts, some little black pigs appeared, pursued by three furious yellow dogs, only to disappear rapidly behind another hut. I was dumbfounded and couldn't help but wonder if I really was looking down on another planet. These humans looked like me, or rather, like Polynesians, and here were dogs and pigs. It was all more and more surprising. The sphere began to return, as did the other spheres, no doubt, that were being monitored by screens I couldn't easily see from my position. The operation, return to ship, was initiated, and all the spheres reabsorbed, without incident, the same as before. I assumed we were about to leave again and so installed myself comfortably in my seat, allowing the force field to restrain me thus. Some moments later, the suns of the planet appeared, two in number, then everything dwindled rapidly, just as it had done when we left Earth. After a time, which seemed quite short, the force field was neutralized and I understood that I was free to get out of my seat. This was a good feeling. I noticed Thou heading towards me accompanied by two of the oldest, if I can say so, of her companions. I remained standing beside my seat before the three astronauts. In order to look at Thou, I was already obliged to raise my head, but when she introduced me, in French, to the elder of them, I felt even smaller. The latter was easily a head taller than Thou. I was completely astonished when she, Biostra, spoke to me correctly, although slowly, in French. She placed her right hand on my shoulder, saying, "I am delighted to have you on board, Michel. I hope that all is well with you and that it continues to be so. May I present Latoli, the second in charge of our spacecraft, myself being what you would call commander-in-chief of the Alitora." Turning to Latoli, she spoke a few words in her own language and Latoli, too, placed her hand on my shoulder. With a warm smile, she repeated my name several times slowly, as would someone who had difficulty pronouncing a new language. Her hand remained on my shoulder and a feeling of well-being, a definite fluid sensation, passed through my body. I was so obviously overcome by this, that the three of them began to laugh. Reading my thoughts, Thou reassured me. Michel, Latoli possesses a special gift, although not rare among our people. What you have been able to experience is a fluid which is magnetic and beneficial, and which emanated from her. It's wonderful, I exclaimed. Please compliment her on my behalf. I then addressed the two astronauts. Thank you for your welcome, but I must confess I am absolutely astounded by what is happening to me. It really is the most incredible adventure for an Earthling such as me. Although I have always believed in the possibility that other planets might be inhabited by human-like beings, I'm still having a hard time convincing myself that this is not a fantastic dream. I had often discussed things such as telepathy, extraterrestrials, and what we call flying saucers with friends on Earth, but they were just words and grand phrases uttered in ignorance. Now I have the proof of what I had suspected for so long regarding the existence of parallel universes, the duality of our beings, and other unexplained occurrences. To experience all that I have in these last few hours is so exciting it takes my breath away. Latoli, admiring my monologue, uttered an exclamation, in words I didn't understand but which thou immediately translated for me. Latoli understands your state of mind perfectly well, Michel. As do I, added Biostra. How could she have understood what I said? She has dipped telepathically into your mind while you were speaking. As you must realize, telepathy is not hindered by language barriers. My astonishment amused them and perpetual smiles played on their lips. Biostra addressed me. Michel, I am going to introduce you to the rest of the crew, if you will kindly follow me. She guided me, by the shoulder, to the furthest desk, where three astronauts were monitoring the instruments. I hadn't yet approached these desks and, even in astral body, I had not paid any attention to the readout of these computers. The glance I now gave them immobilized me completely. The numerals before my eyes were in Arabic. I know the reader will be as surprised as I was, but it was fact. The ones, twos, threes, fours, etc. appearing on the monitors were the same numerals that occur on Earth. Biostra noticed my astonishment. It is true, isn't it, Michel? For you there is one surprise after another. Don't think we are having fun at your expense, as we totally understand your wonder. All will fall into place in good time. For the moment, please allow me to introduce Naola. The first of the astronauts rose and turned towards me. She placed her hand on my shoulder, as Biostra and Latoli had done. It occurred to me that this gesture must correspond to our handshake. Naola addressed me in her own language and then she, too, repeated my name three times, as if she wanted to commit it to memory forever. She was about the same size as thou. The same ceremony followed each time I was introduced, and thus I officially made the acquaintance of all the members of the crew. There was a striking resemblance between them. Their hair, for example, varied only in length and shade, which ranged from a dark copper to a light golden blonde. Some had longer or broader noses than others, but all had eyes of a color which tended towards light rather than dark, and all had very neat, well-shaped ears. Latoli, Biostra and Thao invited me to sit down in one of the comfortable seats. When we were all comfortably installed, Biostra moved her hand in a particular way near the armrest of her seat and I saw coming towards us, floating in the air, four round trays. Each carried a container of yellowish liquid and a bowl of something whitish with a consistency similar to fairy floss but in granulated form. Flat tongs served as forks. The trays came to rest on the arms of our seats. I was quite intrigued. Thou suggested, if I wished to partake of this refreshment, I might like to follow her lead. She sipped from her glass, and I did likewise, finding it quite a pleasant-tasting drink, similar to a water-honey mixture. My companions used the tongs to eat the mixture in the bowls. Following their example, I tasted for the first time what we, on Earth, called manna. Similar to bread, it is, however, extremely light and without any particular flavor. I had eaten only half the amount in my bowl when already, one felt satisfied, which surprised me considering the consistency of this food. I finished my drink and, although I couldn't say I'd dined in fine style, I experienced a sense of well-being and was neither hungry nor thirsty. Perhaps you would have preferred a French dish, Michel? Asked Thao, a smile twitching on her lips. I merely smiled, but Biostra snorted. Just then, a signal drew our attention to the panel. In the center, and in close-up, appeared the head of a woman, resembling my hostess's. She spoke rapidly. My companions turned slightly in their seats to better attend to what was being said. Naola, at her desk, entered into a dialogue with the figure on the screen, just as our television interviewers do on Earth. Imperceptibly, the shot changed from the close-up to a wide angle, revealing a dozen women each in front of a desk. Thou took me by the shoulder and guided me over to Naola, installing me in a seat in front of one of the screens. She took a seat next to me and addressed the people on the monitor. She spoke for some time, rapidly, in her melodious voice, turning frequently towards me. From all evidence, I was the main topic of conversation. When she had finished, the woman reappeared in close-up, responding in several brief sentences. To my great surprise, her eyes fixed on me and she smiled. Hello Michelle, we wish you a safe arrival on Theuba. She waited for my reply. When I had overcome my surprise, I expressed warm thanks. This, in turn, elicited exclamations and numerous comments from her companions, appearing again in a wide-angle shot on the screen. Did they understand? I asked Thou. Telepathically, yes, but they are delighted to hear someone from another planet speak his own language. For most of them, this is quite a rare experience. Excusing herself, Thou readdressed the screen and, what I assumed was a technical conversation, ensued, including Biostra. Eventually, after a smile in my direction and a, see you soon, the picture was cut. I say, cut, because the screen did not simply become blank, rather, the image was replaced by a beautiful, soft color. A mixture of green and indigo blue, which produced a sense of contentment. It gradually faded after a minute or so. Turning to Thou, I asked what it had all meant. Had we rendezvoused with another spacecraft and what was this Theuba or Theula? Theuba, Michelle, is the name we have given to our planet, just as you call yours, Earth. Our intergalactic base has been in touch with us, as we will be arriving in Theuba in 16 of your Earth hours and 35 minutes. This she had checked with a glance at the nearest computer. Those people then are technicians on your planet? Yes, as I just said, at our intergalactic base. This base monitors our spacecraft continually and if we were in trouble for technical or human reasons, in 81% of cases, they would be able to control our safe return to port. This did not particularly surprise me as I had realized I was dealing with a superior race, whose technological possibilities were beyond my comprehension. What did occur to me was that, not only this spacecraft, but also the intergalactic base appeared to be manned by only women. An all-female team such as this would be quite exceptional on Earth. I wondered if Theuba was populated only by women, like space Amazons. I smiled at the image. I have always preferred the company of women rather than men, it was quite a pleasant thought. My question to Thou was direct. Are you from a planet solely populated by women? She looked at me with apparent surprise, then her face lit up with amusement. I was a little concerned. Had I said something stupid? She took me by the shoulder and asked that I follow her. We left the control room and immediately entered a smaller room, called the Halley's, which had quite a relaxing ambience. Thou explained that we would not be interrupted in the room, since the occupants acquired, by their presence, the right to absolute privacy. She invited me to choose one of the many seats that furnished the room. Some were like beds, some like armchairs, others resembled hammocks, while others again, were like high stools with adjustable backs. I would have been difficult to please if one of them did not suit my requirements. Once settled comfortably in a kind of armchair with Thou facing me, I watched as her face became serious again. She started to speak. Michelle, there are no women aboard this spacecraft. If she had told me that I wasn't on a spaceship but rather, in the Australian desert, I would have more readily believed her. Seeing the expression of disbelief on my face, she added, "Neither are there any men." At this, my confusion was absolute. But I faltered, "You are, what? Just robots? No, I think you misunderstand. In a word, Michelle, we are hermaphrodites. You know, of course, what an hermaphrodite is?" I nodded, quite dumbfounded, and then asked, "Is your whole planet inhabited only by hermaphrodites?" "Yes, and yet your face and mannerisms are more feminine than masculine. Indeed, it might appear so, but believe me when I tell you that we are not women, but hermaphrodites. Our race has always been this way. I must confess, this is all very confusing. I'm going to find it difficult to think of you as he, rather than the she I have done since I've been among you. You have nothing to imagine, my dear. We are simply what we are. Human beings from another planet living in a world different from yours. I can understand you would like to define us as one sex or the other, for you think as an Earthling and a Frenchman. Perhaps, for once, you could make use of the neuter gender of English and think of us as it." I smiled at this suggestion but continued to feel disoriented. Only moments ago, I had believed myself to be among Amazons. "But how can reproduction of your race occur?" I asked. "Can an hermaphrodite reproduce?" "Of course we can, exactly as you do on Earth. The only difference being that we genuinely control the births, but that is another story. In good time, you will understand, but now we should rejoin the others." We returned to the control post, and I found myself looking at these astronauts with new eyes. Looking at the chin of one, I found it to be more masculine than it had seemed earlier. Another's nose was decidedly masculine, and the hairstyles of some were now manlier. It occurred to me that we really do see people as we think they are and not as they are. In order to feel less embarrassed among them, I created a rule for myself. I had taken them to be women, as to me they were more like females than males. Thus I would continue to think of them as women and we'd see how that worked. From where I was, I could follow, on the central panel, the movement of stars as we proceeded on our way. Sometimes they appeared enormous and blinding as we passed by a little too closely, a few million kilometers from them. At times, too, we noticed planets of strange colors. I remember one was of an emerald green, so pure I was stunned. It resembled an enormous jewel. Thou approached and I took advantage of the opportunity to ask her about a band of light that had appeared at the base of the screen. This light was composed of what looked like millions of tiny explosions. These are caused by our antimatter guns, as you would call them on Earth, and are, in fact, explosions. At the speed at which we travel, the most minuscule of meteorites would shatter this spacecraft were we to hit it. So, we make use of specific rooms to store certain forms of dust under enormous pressure, and this is fed into our antimatter guns. Our vessel could be considered to be a cosmotron, firing streams of accelerated particles that disintegrate the most microscopic of errant bodies in space, for great distances ahead and to the sides of our spacecraft. This is what allows us to attain speeds that we can. Around our vessel, we create our own magnetic field. Oh please, not so fast. As you know thou, I have no scientific background and if you speak of cosmotrons and accelerated particles, you are going to lose me. I understand the principle, which is certainly very interesting, but I'm not good on technical terms. Can you tell me instead, why the planets on the screen are colored the way they are? Sometimes because of their atmospheres and sometimes because of the gases which surround them. Do you see a multicolored point with a tail at the right of the screen? The thing was approaching at high speed. Second by second, we were better able to admire it. It seemed to explode constantly and change form, its colors indescribably rich. I looked at Thal. It's a comet, she said. It completes a revolution around its sun in approximately 55 of your Earth years. How far are we from it? She glanced at the computer. 4,150,000 kilometers. Thou, I said, how is it you use the numerals of Arabic? And when you speak of kilometers, are you translating for me, or do you actually use this measure? No, we count in Kato and Taki. We use the numerals that you recognize as Arabic, for the simple reason that it is our own system, one which we took to Earth. What? Please explain further. Michel, we have several hours before arriving at Theuba. This is probably the best time to start educating you seriously on certain matters. If you don't mind, we'll go back to the Halley's, where we were before. I followed Thal, my curiosity stronger than ever.
More to come next week. Stay tuned.
I am Barry, it's been the voice within. Kakite, shalom, namaste, masalam. May your God go with you.
This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.